Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Your Honor.
This is Dumpty Dum, sponsored by managers.
Dum dum
dum dum dum dum
dum. Can you do it?
Dum 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 dum
dum dum dum dum dum dum dum dum dum dum dum dum.
Do it.
This is Dumpty Dum, the show about the reality docudrama that has centered an ambush in the heart of the Midlands. I'm the well reasoned intervention that is Royfield Brown, and with me I have the verbal family altercation who is
Rosie Porty,
and we are joined by the hubby in denial who goes by the name of
Peter Fickling.
And the last part of this week's little bust up, folks, is you. Now this week's Dumpty Dum is from Ali's son Jelly Pea. Now he's age 5. Now we have an expression in Jamaica. It's saying, it basically, when you say somebody's got hard ears, it means they're not listening. And boy, oh boy, do Dumpty Dummers have hard ears. Because you want to know what, Rosie Porty?
No one's listening to you.
Which, you know what, is going to be probably going to be the theme of this week's podcast. Because, you know, people have been saying I have been marginalised on this podcast. Just saying. And it's not only the other co-hosts, it's the bloody listeners. Now, I beg and I implore you, please send us in a Dumpty Dum. Because we got now left. But anyway, Rosie Porty, next bit is in red.
So if you would like to sing us a Dumpty Dum or leave us a plot prediction, then call us on 0203 031 3105. Leave us a message on SpeakPipe, or send us a text starting Dum to 07786 200 690. Thanks to our social media supremos, Cosmo for his podcast roundups, Mike Hatton for his character counts, Shambridge for her amazing voices, and to Lucy V. Freeman.
Now, just before we go on any further, you're probably wondering, where's Auntie Kerry Warburton? Where is she, Pete?
She's, I think, sunning herself in sunny Spain in between sporadic showers and downcasts.
Auntie Kerry, we'll be back next week. But we have the wonderful Rosie Porty, who's been shining, or she shone, past tense, on them their Zooms, didn't you?
I did. I loved it. I had lots of fun, especially kind of having a little bit of a poke at you, Royfield. But I'll be very good today. I'll be nice today.
On this week's episode, we called from Liv, Josh in the Pacific Northwest. He's back, Pete. Titian, Lady Garf Garf, Jacqueline Berto, Sandy and Witherspoon. But first, it's our burning topic of the week. Now, what is our topic of the week, you ask? How many forms of denial were there in the Archers last week? Now, Pete Fickling, you're the person that seems to always come up with these kind of like hot topics. So why don't you take the floor, sir? Denial, the Archers, last week, discuss.
Well, what happened was I, knowing that I was going to be chatting to Rosie today, we organised a call, and I just sat there in awe as she kind of dissected the whole thing, one portion at a time. And because I was for once not talking and able to take a kind of spectator's view of the situation, I noticed that she was calling out these sort of, you know, the self-perception versus reality in all these different parts of the show. And the one that really stuck out to me was when she was talking about Philip Moss and, you know, his self-perception that he's this kind of like gregarious, helpful, kind-hearted man. And then some would say that the opposite is the truth. Maybe Rosie's got some more to say about that, because that was, you know, basically she was the genesis.
The genesis of the, we're all in denial, how do we jump out of there? I think for me, there was just this sort of, in a way, split personality construct happening across multiple folk in Ambridge. So we had Alish not recognizing that she has any kind of a problem. We have Chris kind of jumping to his wife's defense, not really owning the fact that she's got a big booze problem and has done for a lot of their marriage. We've got Robert and our Lindy having their kind of own existential crises separately and then using our Lillian as a bit of an intermediary. And then, yes, the kind of the Philip Moss multiple personality disorder in one man, where he's kind of whining about the residents of Ambridge not being his friend, boo-hoo, while he's discussing the horses as though they're commodities. So I think it's quite fascinating how the psychological constructs that the writers have been able to, you know, kind of architect over the last few years are kind of really coming into their own right now.
Let's deal with Philip Moss first, or let's start there anyway. For me, and I think it's a masterful setup, by the way, Rosie P. So props to you, Mrs. But in terms of Philip Moss, he, for me, is the simplest to kind of analyze and to break down, because ultimately he knows what he's doing is wrong. He only reveals his true nature to the one person who he truly trusts, which is his son. And even with his son, he has some level of contempt would be too strong a word, but he doesn't actually, in inverted commas, rate his son. We got a sense some months ago before the coroners that he thinks his son is a bit crap, but it's to do with his ex-wife, isn't it? That the reason why Gavin actually works with Philip, you know, that Philip Moss knows what he's doing is wrong. Otherwise, he'd be going around telling everybody in the village that he has indentured modern day slaves working for him. So he's covering up his the real meat and potatoes, how he makes his money from his business. So how far wrong am I with that as a construct, Rosie P?
I think quite wrong.
Smashing.
Because I think it's kind of, well, he's aware that he's sort of these two different personality types, but he's convinced himself that he's actually doing, you know, the sort of the horses a favour as well. I think in some twisted bit of his brain, he thinks, you know, they'd be on the street otherwise. But then with that kind of chilling phrase he was using about Blake costing more than he was bringing in.
Yeah.
It's really spooky. Like, it's really unsettling hearing that phraseology.
And also his relationship with Gavin, there seems to be that same kind of usefulness versus effort. You know, it's sort of transactional. I mean, I know that we're big fans of Donald Trump on this show, but when you hear Donald Trump being discussed, you know, if famously he views every relationship, even, you know, his family ones, as transactional. What can people do for me? How do people make me look good? And so, you know, when Gavin's being useful, he's being showered with praise. Or when Gavin needs coercing as well. And rather pretentiously, the other day I was sort of positing that, you know, maybe Gavin was where he sort of practiced and mastered his art of sort of, because you assume that these people are working semi voluntarily for him, that they are locked in a rather sort of damaging relationship with Philip and Gavin.
But I think we were, some months ago, we led to the conclusion that Philip's business empire is a lot to do with the relationship which he had with his last wife. The split up was acrimonious. And maybe it's because she didn't approve of what he was doing or whatever, but there is kind of like, kind of something there. But in terms of the construct of a drama, he's a villain. So when I say he's the simplest really to work out, you know, he's, well, I agree to a point, Rosie, that there's a level of denial going on with him, but that's only so he can actually present himself as this upright businessman. He actually knows what he's doing is morally, ethically, legally wrong. He knows it. The reason why he has to keep this all quiet and he can only talk to Gavin about it is because it's indefensible and he knows it.
But isn't that part of the kind of the broader problem that people have when they're talking about evil, is they need to have this kind of binary concept of good and evil? And actually the trouble with the, you know, the Rob Titchener's and the Gavin Mosses, sorry, the Philip Mosses of this world, is that, you know, if you confronted them directly, they would give you the same justification that they give themselves every day. So yes, he understands that people wouldn't understand why he does things the way he does. They wouldn't understand why he needs to, you know, to keep his business running this way. But he's probably drunk the Kool-Aid a bit himself. He's probably fairly convinced of his version of events. And I think maybe that's what Rosie was hinting at, but she can soon correct me.
I think so. I think he's in a psychological state where he thinks everything he does is correct. And it just depends on the setting as to actually what he's getting up to.
Yeah, and we're back to Trump again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But for me, there is a difference, at least in the journey of where the characters are between him and Alice. Alice does not honestly believe that she has a problem. Whereas I contend that Philip Moss knows that what he's doing is wrong, hence he's concealing it. Yes, Alice is concealing her drinking, but she's also concealing the extent of her drinking to herself.
Oh, no, I know that Rosie has been listening to this week's episodes, because I've seen her. I've been sort of trying to watch through sort of Vaseline lens to the tweets firing left, right and centre. So I haven't listened to this week. So last Friday, the cliffhanger was that publicly Alice had said very clearly, you know, what are you saying? You know, but she's in front of Chris. We've only heard her talk about it in front of Chris. I can't wait for Monday or Tuesday or whenever it is. When are we going to hear Alice's inner voice or Alice talking to someone else about saying, you'll never believe what Emma said? Or as she tries to reconcile, because no matter, despite the fact that she doesn't like Emma, and that's obviously been well advertised, Emma is inflexible, inflexible, completely trustworthy, and a very reliable source of information. And, you know, that will not be lost on Alice.
I think what may happen is the putative surprise 50th birthday party that was kind of kiboshed by these imaginary friends that Ian and Adam apparently have in the Lake District. Who knew? But, you know, Alice has sort of managed to get half of Lidl's booze bucket in place. She's got her party bags ready to go. With the condoms, I think she might just have some kind of meltdown where she basically starts, you know, knocking back the half-price Prosecco and goes on a bit of a mad ramble through the village. Because I think, you know, at some point, you know, she did in one of her monologues talk about, you know, being late for meetings at her previous company and not really showing up there. So she was beginning to show a bit of awareness, but it's such a big thing to admit that I think she's going to be, in a way, pushed into it. And I can see happening some kind of car crash, physical or metaphorical, after she downs half of the Prosecco for Ian's party and just loses it.
Last week, Royfield wasn't particularly happy with my defence of the monologues. And I think actually this is a good example of where you want to hear directly from the character. I would love to see Alice tear the party to pieces and go on a sort of like, you know, booze soaked, you know, one woman march around the village. But equally, I would like to hear her inner voice, because that's I think been the real success of the recent monologues, has been the way they've been able to sort of peel back the lid and show you the you know, the private thoughts.
Mm. So there was a trio or a triptych of denial kind of storylines, and then the last one was the Snells. So Rosie P, in what way can we link the previous other two storylines and denial with the normally happy couple that is Linda and Robert?
Well, it's toe-curlingly really upsetting what's happening with Robert and Linda, in that they're on such different tracks. And they're so, it just feels like they're so far away from each other. And that, you know, Robert's in his car talking about erectile dysfunction with Lillian, and Linda's at home, you know, in her jazzy caftan and her long earrings. And it's just so sad that they haven't been able to reach out towards each other. And I think that Robert is just so worried about her fragility, and is just, he loves her so much that he's just terrified of doing anything that could hurt her, given the fact that she was at death's door only a few months ago. And he just doesn't have the words to express that to her. And Linda is such a proud, strong woman, and she's been literally blown sideways by what happened with Gavin and Blake at Gay Grables, that her whole personality has been shunted. And if there was ever a need for some couples counselling in Ambridge, this is definitely it. And, you know, Elizabeth's therapist should be getting over there or getting on a virtual Zoom, because those two just need to talk it out. The sad thing is that
Robert's concern is not just sort of doing damage to her psychologically, but actually physically. You know, making love to her could physically hurt her. And it feels like a large portion of it could be tidied up very quickly if they were just one of them would break the seal and have that chat. And that's made it all the sadder for me, and all the more poignant, is seeing them so close, because their love for each other is so deep that, you know, it would only take a small amount of time of them kind of unbottling and unburdening for them to be back in each other's arms, you know, maybe with some cushions and some safety devices.
A harness, maybe.
Yeah, made out of old horseshoes by Chris, potentially.
By Chris. That would be a useful ornament, wouldn't it?
Yes, exactly. The strength of his work would be finally put to use.
In what way is Linda, and in her position, exhibiting denial in the sense that we've kind of constructed it this week?
Linda is mourning her past self, and, you know, and we got a glimpse into that in the monologue. She was very clear about that, and she was sort of like joking with Monty about, you know, how she was sort of letting him down and how she wishes that she could be stronger. And she actually talked about the fact that she needs to reconcile herself with not just her the physical changes, but her sort of, you know, the her emotional fragility. And so maybe her denial is more complex than you know, Alice and Philip, because, you know, there it's total, it's sort of day and night. Whereas with Linda, she's aware of it, and I think, you know, it's sort of, it's interesting to watch that. And you were talking about Robert as well. I mean, I got beaten up by a group of men when I was in my sort of early 20s, and I was sort of shocked by how it didn't really affect me in the moment, but weeks later, I really, you know, a sense of kind of masculinity I didn't even realize I had was sort of profoundly challenged. And I sort of see that with Robert, and I see that with Linda, where she's sort of, you know, she's kind of in real time coming to terms with the kind of the emotional damage and the gap between, as I said, the gap between her past self and her current self. And it must be very, very difficult for this fictional person. So I just realized I was talking about Linda like she's a real person, you know.
Rosie.
Mm-hmm. It feels like she's a real person.
I've said this so many times, but Linda is, I mean, it's hard to think of a better character in the Archers in all different settings.
Yeah. And definitely one that within this situation we're all rooting for, because we massively empathize. And I think that's the most heartwarming thing about this whole upsetting thing, I should say, about this storyline. You can completely see it from both angles. Robert just wants to protect, just wants her to heal and to get better. And for him, not hurting her is definitely part of that. And for Linda, she needs him to reach out and to touch her to help her heal and to make her feel whole. And it's just so wonderfully done. And then for reasons of a dramatic construct, we have to have Lillian being Henry Kissinger in between the two, you know, bouncing from pillar to post, you know, running messages, kind of getting things slightly wrong. And you feel and you hear the anguish that both parties then actually feel when they have probably one of the most stable and loving relationships in the whole village.
That's quite a moment, Royfield. I've just realised no matter how many parallel universes there are, you're the only Royfield who will ever compare Lillian Bellamy to Henry Kissinger. That is throughout space and time a unique moment.
Peter, thank you for that, sir. But now we can have a little bit of this.
Hello, Ambridge 3962.
And we start over in Brummagem, the capital of the Midlands. It's Birmingham and it's our Liv.
Hi, Royfield and Dapsy Dammers everywhere. I'm Liv, I'm from Birmingham, and I'm a first-time caller-innerer. My arch's vintage is, I think, a kitchen-knob, because I started listening when Helen stabbed Rob, and I've never looked back, so yeah. I'm a recent listener to Dumpty Dum, but as I've had lots of time in lockdown, I've managed to catch up with all the episodes now. And thank you for everything you're doing. Thank you for keeping going during lockdown. And yeah, just thank you for an amazing podcast. Now on to the Archers. So last week, Emma annoyed me because she was trying to do the right thing by confronting Alice and Chris. That was just not the right way to go about it. And she made everything worse. And now Chris is very much in denial, so is Alice. But it just didn't work. And I'm also loving Philip and Gavin. I really hope that this storyline is resolved, because it's just very... the tension is building every time they talk about their slaves, so I really hope it gets resolved soon. Anyway, thank you for everything you do. Bye.
Well, it was lovely to hear from Liv, first time caller in her, again from Sunny Brum. I wonder if she wanted to say Tarara a bit like Sarah does. I think it's really interesting the reactions that have happened in relation to Emma's intervention, with some people being fairly angry at the approach that Emma took, and I think with others being a little bit more sympathetic, given I think the circumstances around kind of Alice pretending that, you know, Ed was in love with her. And Liv is a big fan of the storyline to do with Philip and Gavin, but is hoping for, I think, a speedy resolution. I'm not so sure it's going to be that speedy. I think they're going to drag this one out.
Let's hope. I mean, I'm very publicly a big fan of Philip and Gavin, and want as much of them for as long as possible. But I know that's not necessarily the opinion in vogue. I've got to say, Liv, it takes a lot of guts to be, you know, call in and slam Emma on your first call. You know, Emma is pretty damn popular. And, you know, if the last few Dumpty Dums, I don't think we could shut up about how much we love Emma. So fair play to you for, you know, giving her a bit of a kicking. I thought Emma had the right amount of desperation and sadness in her voice when she approached Chris, and they did patronize her, and sort of like she did try and ask Chris for the privacy needed to deliver the message in a more sensitive sisterly way, and was denied that. So I was quite surprised to hear that Emma was getting a bit of a kicking. But Rosie, I've been intentionally avoiding Archers this week. What sort of brutal comeback has she got?
Oh, we can't talk about it. We can't talk about it. It's a surprise for next week. No, we can't. But what I would say is that I think the way that Chris spoke to his sister was just disgusting. And
yeah, that's
Chris
what I thought.
Was ganging up on her and bringing up all the stuff to do with the house. And after Chris and Alish, you know, gave Emma the princely sum of £3,000 to help her.
Yeah, you educated me about this last week.
Yeah, they're living in a free home. They've got minimal expenses, and Emma was effectively on the bones of her arse, lovely phrase, and was really desperate. And for her brother to just kind of, I think, kick her to the curb at that point, and now, is just unforgivable. So I sense a massive family rift until Chris wises up and realizes that his sister only has his best interests at heart.
Yeah, because when I spoke to Rosie last week, Royfield, I didn't realise, I'd forgotten that Chris had given some money to Emma, because I was saying, who was it who's told the village that Emma came to them for money? And then Rosie pointed out it was Ruth, Jim and Peggy that she'd been to. And I thought that Jim and Peggy would never break Emma's, privacy by you know, gossiping about it. So we then worked out it must have been Ruth who'd sort of like spread the word. But so that, yeah, but anyway, I thought it was absolutely outrageous that he would throw that back in Emma's face. And, you know, and she, as I said, she'd asked for privacy. And, you know, Alice couldn't, you know, couldn't wait to get stuck in to Emma when they were, you know, having that conversation.
Yeah, just looking at this from the perspective of somebody who is steeped in the history of the UN from 1945, its inception in San Francisco, through to the modern organisation, now which has its headquarters in New York, is that Emma is no diplomat, is she? She went along and actually was delivering the right message, but the wording was all wrong. The wording in that communique was all wrong. And if somebody came in, you know, in effect, all guns are blazing. And I understand the reason. And the reason why she didn't come armed with the right diplomatic language, Henry Kissinger style, is because there's this whole nonsense of Ed being into Alice. So, you know, she's bristling, but she pieced it together. You know, this is what's going on. Her sister-in-law likes the juice, right? She's an alcoholic, but she, because it's Emma, it doesn't take much to set her off. And if I was Chris, it would have set me off too. Did Chris say the right things in the moment? Absolutely not. But that's what made it such a great scene.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, because he was no Henry Kissinger for that moment. She couldn't calm the situation. She just went in effect, all guns blazing, in effect.
Diplomacy is not Emma's greatest skill, but it's such a difficult thing to do, to go and talk to a family member about something that difficult. And, you know, hopefully their family's like mine, and there'll be a lot of shouting and ranting and raving, and then calmer thoughts will, you know, appear through the night. Because I think in reflection, Chris would have to think about how difficult it must be to go to your brother or sister and say that. And also to stay the course. When Alice insisted on staying in the room, the fact that she didn't chicken out and walk out the door, that takes guts. She could have just, you know, bottled it and walked out. So I hope that, you know, yes, she hasn't been a diplomat, but I hope he recognises, you know, even if he doesn't believe in it, that the effort she's made.
Hmm. Okie dokie. On that note, let's go to the Upper East West Side, and it's a touch of our Witherspoons.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. Mercy.
Greetings, everyone in Dumpty Dum Towers and all Dumpty Dummers around the world. It's Witherspoon and Angus Haggis here. I'm on Royfield's side and must disagree with Auntie Carrie and Peter on the issue of the future inclusion of monologues. I enjoyed how the dialogue propelled the plot and, more importantly, the conflict forward this past week on The Archers. There was the parallel set of sibling fights, first between Susan and Tracy, and then between Susan's own two children. Tracy handled her conflict with a deft, humorous hand, which seemed to be heading toward an amicable resolution, while Emma's self-righteousness played out like a bullet in a china shop. We know she's right about Alice, but a lighter touch would have served her better in confronting her brother and sister-in-law. I thought she intended to talk only with Chris, but that didn't happen. It seems her intentions were both one of being concerned and helpful and one of being holier than thou. This week also marked the return of that dastardly father and son duo, Philip and Gavin. It's always so jarring when they so consistently refer to their workers as horses. Philip seems otherwise domestic and caring toward Kirsty, but in truth he is cruel and unempathic. Who knows what kind of cold and xenophobic father he had? Oh, wait, we're talking about the Mosses, not the Trumps. It's a confusing time. But what I want to note is the brief reference to Tracy's lawsuit. On the face of it, it seems frivolous, but maybe that will be the undoing of the Trump, Moss crime syndicate. A good lawyer, let's pick one at random, Usha, will unravel everything through the discovery process. Let's hope so. Talk to you soon.
Well, there's a lot to go through there. Very, very quickly, first of all, do we know if the horses thing, where does that come from? Because I swear I heard it before this plotline started on The Archers, but is that correct parlance? Have you heard it before?
That's what gang masters call their slaves. Oh, okay. So they are completely bang on with that.
Where do you get that information from? What's the background for it?
Well, there was a recent play on Radio 4 that was set in Wales, where they had a kind of a similar setup. I think it's been in a couple of documentaries around gangmasters. So with the cockle pickers, who unfortunately passed away.
Oh God, that was awful. Yeah.
You know, in Lancashire, it came up there. So I think it's definitely you know, actual phraseology that is used by both the police and you know, social security.
I think that's where
for these folk.
It was Lincolnshire, wasn't it? And yeah, that's where I think I must remember it from. That was very, very sad. They were Vietnamese, weren't they? Vietnamese folk who were sort of forced out onto the wash. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Keep it light, Peter. I obviously hold Witherspoon in the highest esteem, but it's quite upsetting for me to hear him being so wrong in disagreeing with me and Kerry at the beginning of his call in. What do you think, Royfield?
Well, you might want to get used to it, Pete, because you're going to get called that a few times in this episode by the great caller in us. That's all I've got to say.
You told us that sort of breaking the fourth wall. Hello, listeners. Royfield said before the show that basically I was in for a right old kicking today. So if I've sounded unusually sort of nervous and cowed, that's why. I'm just every caller in era is like, oh my God, here it comes. Here's the big Royfield's big army. Kind of, I'm you know, I'm the meager Spartans in the chasm, and the huge Persian hordes are about to kind of pour down on top of me. But anyway, so I'm buckling in. Back to show.
Oh, right. Okay. So shall I press a button then?
Yes, please.
I'll do that then.
Hello, Royfield, Kerry and Peter, and hello to all Dumpty Dummers. This is Sandy. I'm a first-time caller-innerer, and I've been listening since about January 2018, which I think makes me an Anisha. I've had a few interesting jobs in my career, but probably the most broadcast-worthy was a spell as a live arm guard. That always gets a bit of a woo around the table, unlike my current profession as an accountant. I've listened to Dumpty Dum for almost the same amount of time, and I loved listening to Lucy and Royfield, but I adore the new format too, and I missed Peter a couple of weeks back when he was benched for Sonny. I'm still really enjoying the COVID secure arches, and I was just wondering whether anybody picked up on the writer's intended sarcasm to the monologue naysayers by way of Ed and Emma discussing Susan's angst regarding her squeaky voice. And Emma said something along the lines of, well, if they don't like it, they can just switch off and there's more important stuff to worry about going on in the world. I really did laugh out loud. Thanks for all that you do. Take care, Sandy.
Oh, Sandy, isn't she lovely?
Mob accountant Sandy calling in, yeah.
Mm. Mm.
What's a life arm guard? Or did I mishear that?
That's what I heard too. Just a badass with a gun that just protects people.
That's where I got the mob thing from. I'm like, okay, she can't have gone from this sort of woo-worthy, exciting job to accountancy without sort of, you know, keeping her hand in. So I'm glad she brought that up about Susan and Tracy. I absolutely adored that. I seem to be part of the few on that one. I really, really enjoyed it. I didn't care if it was realistic or not. Kerry was giving it a bit of a kicking on Twitter, I think. Yeah, I just thought it was knockabout humour, and for me, there needs to be at least a sort of 10 or 20% of that in the archers for me to sort of enjoy it.
I love Tracy and Susan, and I love Tracy's sense of humour and the fact that she can wind her sister up so easily. And I think one hilarious moment was Susan referring to herself as Madonna at one point
because
of, you know, somebody trolling her. Yeah, so at one point she was saying, you know, when people become well-known like Madonna, you know, people try and take them down. You're going to go. So there's a very strange image of like a tabard with some conical bras sticking out of it. Very disturbing.
It was definitely out of the monologues, the need to get Susan on the air. But then they could have quite easily just sort of segued away from that. But she's now got her own jingle almost. They sort of, the full Radio Borsetshire thing with the BBC reference was going on. And, you know, the BBC is undergoing a lot of change, so it's going to be quite interesting to see. Is this a sort of a internal insurrection from BBC staffers using Susan away as a sort of Trojan horse for getting their sort of union views across? Radio Borsetshire just starts to receive some cuts. Susan's show's under threat. Columbo comes back to sort of make a desperate plea for her saviour. I don't know, I think it's going to be quite interesting.
I love the fact that sort of people were actually phoning the number. So when the BBC Radio Borsetshire, you know, the number was read out, people were calling in.
It's a,
to
a
get
bit of
through
a shame
to
they,
Susan.
It's a bit of a shame they didn't hook it up to something, you know, some kind of promotional tape.
I think we should suggest that on Twitter, because I think, you know, there are hundreds of people out there who need advice from someone with the life experience of Susan Carter, married to a pig man for all those years, you know.
They could have randomised it. They could have had it going to the three main sort of groups under threat: alcoholics, horses, and sisters who have to put oil in their father's ears. Royfield, on your trip to Germany, did your daughter take the time to oil your waxy ears, or did you not have time in between sightseeing?
She didn't, and neither did she wash my underpants beforehand, which is another thing which Tracy did. But thank you for mentioning Deutschland. It was a wonderful trip. But you know what though, Pete? We have little time for these asides this week, because we've got a ton of calls. And from Sandy, we move to an old caller in of some vintage. It's Jacqueline Berthaud.
Hi, it's Jacqueline Berthaud from Saint-Gwen in Brittany, France. I'm a long-time non-caller in, but I'm a caller in of old. I've seen quite a lot of stuff flashing across my screen on social media about the Alice, Chris and the alcohol story. So I decided this morning to go for a very long walk with the dogs and caught up with both the Archers and Dumpty Dum, because I seem to be having to avoid Twitter and Facebook or whatever, so as not to read anything. So my view of it is that Emma was not the person to confront Chris and or Alice about the drinking at work. But what amazed me was how Alice's self-deceit was portrayed. Now, I've lived with two addicts in my life, not both addicted to alcohol. And I have to say that it's the deceiving, that self-deceiving of the addict that fools the partner, Chris, of course, in this case, to have fears and doubts about whether there really is a problem. But so I'm not blaming, like a lot of people are, Chris for assisting and not seeing and being blind to Alice's addictions. And I think the story will run and we'll have quite a long way to go yet on it. But Emma was definitely not the person to do that. She's far too impetuous and she shouldn't have carried on the conversation, because there's such bad feeling between her and Alice. Anyway, well, thank you for the new format of both Facebook and Dumpty Dum. I'll always miss Lucy V. Freeman, but I'm very much enjoying listening to Kerry and Peter's conversations with the lovely Royfield. Bye for now.
Wonderful to hear Jacqueline Berthaud's dulcet tones again, all the way from Brittany in France. And I'm hoping that she was successful in her local election that happened in the recent months. And the key themes that she was pulling out was that, I think as we've discussed already, Emma is not necessarily the best diplomat to go in and have an intervention. But she also was drawing on some personal experiences of a couple of addicts. And the key issue that she had was that their self-deception meant that the person living with them was really hidden from the truth in terms of the addiction. So she felt that people were being a bit unfair to Chris, because if the addict is such a good liar, then their partner is just really not going to know what's going on.
Yeah, and Chris seems very much blinded by his love for Alice. You know, he's determined to see the best in her. And you know, I think luckily for me, I have never been with an addict, but I can imagine, you know, that must be the challenge. You've committed so much of your life, you've dedicated so much of your life to this other person. And so it's kind of in your interest to see the best in them and want the best for them.
I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Kerry, but some weeks ago did talk about the level of adornment that Chris actually has for Alice. You know, that, it, you know, there's Chris almost feeling like he isn't kind of really worthy of Alice. You know, the power dynamic between the pair of them was really being kind of like brought out with this, in that, yes, he's been lied to. And Jacqueline makes an excellent point that level of denial and then deception is really hard for even the closest around you to really realise what the problem is. But then also there is this weird power dynamic between the pair of them, which you can only really think is to do with one being an Aldridge and one being a Carter, and, you know, the level of privilege and entitlement that goes with being an Aldridge.
And also Alice has talked, you know, sort of in pain about the pressure of being the golden child. And it doesn't just have to be her parents and her siblings who bought into that. You know, Chris could have bought into that as well. He's married this glorious, hyper-successful, hyper-intelligent woman. And although, Rosie, what was it you were telling me? Massively overqualified for her life in Ambridge. But in Ambridge terms, this incredibly successful and well-qualified woman. And, yeah, and why question that?
I mean, she's got, a first-class degree in engineering. And what is she doing kind of pootering around in this village? Like, it doesn't really make sense that she hasn't made more of her degree. And I think that she's sort of trapped in this golden cage by her father. And the alcoholism, I think, has come out of that sense of she's trapped. She's trapped in her little cottage. She's trapped in her life. And the only way that she can really escape that is through alcohol. And I think that's probably quite realistic for lots of people out there when they feel as though they don't have the agency over their own lives. And she's just kind of being shunted along towards eventually becoming a mother, even though she doesn't want to be a mother. And I think the alcohol is there to kind of cushion her from that reality.
Has she actually said that she doesn't want to be a mother? Is it just a not now, when it's right kind of conversation? Or have we actually heard her say to Debbie or anyone that she is not something she sees for herself?
I think she's pushed back against her mum, because Jenny's been going on about this for ages, and she's always said not yet to Chris, but she's just right. She's just not, you know, maternal, and she's only in her kind of early 30s, so there's no massive rush right now. And I really, you know, she needs to kind of crack on and do something for herself, because if she doesn't, there could be some very sad consequences down the line.
Yeah.
Now, Jacqueline Berto, thank you for that. Now we're going on to Lady Garth Garth.
Hi, Dumpty Dum. This is Lady Garth Garth. I'm not a first-time caller in era, but I haven't called in for about 4 years since the Helen and Rob storyline came to a climax. But I haven't missed an episode of Dumpty Dum. I really, really enjoy it. My first point was just to say I love the new format. I think Royfield, Kerry and Peter work really, really well together. But Royfield did seem to be getting quite bullied at the start of mm-hmm. last episode. And as a teacher, I'm in a union, and that's something really important to me. And I was just interested whether there's a kind of podcasting union you can join. My Archers related point is about veganism. I teach a lot of young people, and lots of them are very interested in this. And I think veganism is on the increase. And I was just wondering, apart from Kate, whether there were younger members of the characters that you thought could turn vegan, particularly in the farming families, and whether that would cause a conflict. Anyway, sorry for my ramblings. Thank you very much, and speak to you soon. Bye.
So Lady Garth Garth wants there to be a podcasting union. Wouldn't they just be kind of in the National Union for Journalists, Royf? Or is there a special one for podcasters?
Well, there should definitely be a special one for podcasters who've been trying their best for 6 years, ploughing a certain furrow with something that they love. Then they invite a friend on, think it's all going to be shits and giggles, and then they turn out to be vicious. There should be a unit specifically for that type of podcaster. So I don't know about the NUJ, whether they can have some kind of subgroup, some subcommittee within that august union. But definitely right here and now, I think Peter Ficklin has got something to answer for. And I'm really glad that Lady Garth Garth felt that exercised, that after not calling in for 4 years, this was the moment for her to call in, because she couldn't take it anymore.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Which character would be a vegan? I'm thinking that maybe Ben might be a good candidate. Maybe he'd be flirting with some other woman, and, you know, that would sort of, he's, you know, desperate to impress. He would sort of update his diet. There was that kind of whole plot about the cooking that we could sort of tap into. What do you think, Rosie?
I think in terms of like impressing people with their Thai-inspired curries, absolutely. Ben in his little bright orange tango car. But I think, Pete, I think you may have, perhaps you kind of like missed what Royf was saying there. I think he was looking for kind of like a, you know, hands down apology for the bullying that you've been subjecting him to.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I think that Royfield is very respect-worthy and upstanding and confident man who doesn't need anyone's protection. And I treat him as such. I respect him enough to treat him honestly and with candour, and I hope that it's taken in kind.
But you know what it is, though, Peter? It's the bullying, it's exclusion, which is a form of bullying. You know, there's you and Kerry having your lovely little WhatsApp chats,
yeah.
And
yeah, we do talk a lot, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's also some news on that as well from Peter and I last week, isn't there, Pete?
Two lovely chats, Rosie. Thank you. Yeah, it was very enjoyable, yeah.
Very in-depth sociological discussion, psychological discussion. It was fascinating learning all about Catford architecture. Like, I learned a lot from those.
Yes, wow. It was, Royfield?
Rosie.
I mean, Royfield, you are a very, very busy man. You have a wide number of interests and, you know, a wide number of business interests as well. And it's difficult, let's put it that way, to sometimes get you to engage in our conversations. And I can't speak on Kerry's behalf. She's, you know, currently waist deep in sangria and other, you know, beverages. But, you're always welcome. I'll just say that as far as I'm concerned on any conversation.
Right.
In fact, did I not message you just yesterday saying, wouldn't it be lovely to catch up next week?
No.
Did I not? Oh, I can see someone else.
Yeah.
That was somebody else.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, right. That was my friend Tay, maybe. All right.
All right,
yeah.
So that is your apology. Yeah.
I've talked on the topic, yes.
All right. Great. All right. Now, moving swiftly on, it's Josh who called in before and was aghast at what we accused him of.
Greetings, positive Peter and kindly Kerry. I do hope that you've invited the rarefied Royfield along to this week's podcast. He's a friendly chap and has many interesting points to say on the topic of the archers, so it would be an honest shame if this turns out to be one of your tete-a-tetes that you have accidentally recorded as a podcast. To be honest, I am still in shock at the conjecture from the three of you back in July that I work for the current administration here in America. I struggle to find the words to express just how unlikely the nature of that scenario is. Although perhaps I need not be so self-censoring after last week's trip from double entendre to single entendre to honest and direct discussion of what exactly should constitute magic time. I am calling fairly early in the week, so I don't know where the plot line with Philip will go for now, but it brought my mind back to a point that I had stuck in my head for some time when I started listening to Dumpty Dum this spring. I know that Philip and Gavin use the phrase horses, and it seems a reasonable depiction of the dehumanizing language that would be used in that circumstance to square internal and external views of oneself. But I do not think that we, the listener, should even ingest. I suggest we use their names and refer to the events that are happening to them as adjectives to reflect their value beyond their current circumstances. Finally, while I'm glad to see dialogue re-enter the show, I hope that the monologues do not go away completely, at least not until some of my previous fever dreams come true and we can hear Natasha reading her credit card statement out loud or Henry babbling for 13 straight minutes. Let's give the academic archers something meaty to deconstruct.
Wow. What a tour de force. I don't remember you guys accusing him of being a member of the Trump administration or being his spokeslady. Did that happen?
I think that's a sort of a shock, a symptom of shock. It was briefly mentioned that he might be a member of the Trump administration, but the main thrust of it was that we thought he was some sort of deep state, kind of secret agent sort of type. And I'm sorry about the Trump administration accusation, but now I'm thinking there's this kind of slightly academic, intellectual sort of approach talking about the, you know, sociological elements, and I'm maybe some kind of research institute, some kind of Area 51-esque sort of deep state, you know, civilian population control institute.
Nothing's off the table when it comes to Josh, I don't think. And I think it was interesting, actually, he was saying that we should talk about Blake and Kenzie rather than referring to them as the horses, which I really agree with. And I think we should, going forward, refer to them with their real names rather than using that nomenclature.
And I swear I'm not saying this just to irritate Royfield, but Rosie, didn't we talk last week about how because we don't ever hear from Blake and from Kenzie, it's not like with Rob and Helen. With Rob, you heard his victim, you heard her distress, you saw Helen being distorted and manipulated. And I think my slight reluctance to put down my affection for the Moss brothers. So go, you know, is rooted in the fact that we never hear from them. So it's still this kind of theorized or sort of learnt distress or reported distress.
It's that disconnect, isn't it? So I think it really is that. Because we haven't actually heard from them. It's all reportage. And until we actually hear their voices, we're not going to have that sense of connection.
Well, we did hear from Blake in the hospital. He was voiced.
Wasn't he?
He was. I take your general point, Peter.
I'm not just disagreeing with you for the sake of it, Royfield. I don't like to criticise the writers, but that was such a thin, sort of weak caricature. I didn't really feel there was an opportunity to connect with him at all. Factually, there was
Peter,
a voiced character.
What type of monster are you? Right. No, wait a minute. Let's just go back to the hospital scene.
The type that repeatedly bullies you and tries to shame and belittle you on air. That's the kind of monster.
Well, apart from the bleeding obvious, what other type of monster are you, Peter? Now, let's go back to that hotel. Let's go back to that hospital scene. Right.
What hotel room was that? Was this another kind of like weekend break that I don't know about?
Very, very specialist hotel, yeah.
Blake was terrified. He was not only literally killed, you know, because of the explosion, he was also terrified. And you got menace from Philip. And him, and then Blake cowering. That's what I seem to remember from, you know, and, you know, tell them that I'm your uncle, etc. Right.
That's all Philip. And, it says a lot about you in a good way that you sort of projected that concern onto him. But you didn't walk away. They didn't put in the little tidbits that managed to sort of help you round out the character and develop a sense of who he is. And I know it's a cramped scene. There was a lot going on. But I just we still don't have a sense of who they are as people beyond their relationship with the Mosses.
Vulnerable.
Yes, but that's a caricature. That's not a person.
Mm. All right. Talking about engaging characters is Titian, and she's bringing up the rear in terms of the caller inners this week.
Hello, Titian here. Long time not caller innering, but here I am. I have a few things to say. Please, 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 can we have more positivity? Let's stop whinging about the monologues. I think they're the numbskulls for grown-ups. Google it if you don't know what I mean. I'm with Sunny. Bernie Mac and I agree as well. It's much better to have some archers to listen to and whinge about than none. Much love to Bernie Mag, Dee Dee Midders, Nosilla, Auntie Jean, Jojo, Lucy and Robert. Bye-bye.
Well, beyond the very warm and lovely sort of community notices, I just heard Peter's right, Peter's right, Peter's right all the way through that. So wasn't that exactly what I was saying last week, Royfield? And you were disagreeing with. I'm leaning into the bullying now. I can't be bothered to hide it anymore. I'm just going to go.
You're leaning in. Are you Sheryl Sandberg now? There's many personalities coming out from Peter in this recording.
Yeah, absolutely. The act is over. Nice, Peter's
How
gone.
Big is your hair? I'm just wondering now, because it takes quite a lot of bouffon to get the Sheryl look. So, yeah, I'm impressed.
I am slow to take compliments, but as I've got older and I've started to develop a bit of a silver fox look, I get a lot of compliments on my hair. I'll just say that.
So not true, Peter. You're a very handsome man.
Well.
Now you're trying to follicle shame me because I have no hair. So the bullying doesn't stop with you, does it, Fickling? But Rosie, where do you stand on the monologues? Because obviously you weren't with us last week when I said I wanted these things to be over and dispensed with and never to rear their heads ever again.
I think you're wrong on that, Roy. And I think the reason for that is that we've heard kind of the inner workings of Nakasha. We heard about her dad with his bipolar disorder. We're beginning to hear Alice's sort of true character coming out in terms of her self-doubt. The beautiful scenes with Robert and Lindy just wouldn't have been possible in terms of their sort of the tenderness and the kind of the weeping that ensued from various people listening to that, I imagine. So I think they've been done really, really well towards the end of the process. And at the beginning, I just think we should be saying, you know, thank you that they kept going and the script writers were able to kind of move this forward. Because I mean, as Titian says, they've worked, you know, really hard. They've kept it going. And I think we should be really grateful for that. And I would like to see, on a shorter form basis, the monologues carrying on.
I
I don't think I fundamentally disagree with the first half of what you said. And I think I said as much on the show in that I'm glad there was something rather than nothing. I think I've said that. And definitely at the start of the monologues, I did say that I understand the production problems of all concerned, whether it is the technicians, the writers, the actors, the script editor, et cetera, in keeping the whole ship afloat.
There is a sort of last week, Phil, you said that one of the problems you had with the monologues was it took away the listener, that the listener's job was to sort of, you know, insert their imagination, not job, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, they granted us an opportunity to sort of see another slice of the village, to see a whole nother kind of, like, you know, a whole nother aspect of the village. And you know, and has allowed our imaginations to roam a bit freer and just kind of like sort of fill in some of the gaps more effectively. So you know, I when I listened back to the podcast last week, I did hear you say that and think that's a very, very good point, and one that I was slightly jealous I hadn't thought of myself. But yeah, I think it I took the point, but also think that it's offered another whole perspective. Sorry, I couldn't have mangled that more if I tried.
That I'll leave that in the edit then, shall I, Peter?
That's fair enough. I deserve it.
Fantastic. So that's a call rinneras, our Rosie. Now, do we have any he-mails with an H?
We have two he-mails this week, Royf.
Mm.
Shall I crack on with reading them out?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Okay. So the first is from the amazingly named Silver Girl, mm-hmm. and the title is... Dumpty Dum, Gavin is a horse as well! Exclamation mark. So Silver Girl says, just catching up on last week, the irony is that the way Gavin is coerced and controlled by his father and constantly seeking his approval, reliant on him for shelter and accommodation, Gavin himself is no different from the other horses. Discuss. Kiss, kiss. I like the kissing.
And also, I like that as an idea, because I hadn't thought of that. Had you?
It hadn't occurred to me, and I think she's absolutely got it spot on. He is really similar. He's terrified of his dad. He has no external form of support. So maybe Philip did begin his journey to being a gang master with controlling his son.
But remember, though, their relationship is somewhat complex, because remember, Gavin was introduced by him demanding that his father spent 30,000 quid on his wedding. So as much as he is in awe of his father and cowers, there is also a level of entitlement that Gavin has as well.
Yeah. And all of that, was it 30,000 grand to go to Bali to marry Kelly?
Mm.
And then that's all fallen by the wayside.
And not even a mention of Kelly now. He licked his wounds for all about 3 days before he got over that. So.
And tried to get onto Emma, but Emma wasn't having any of it.
Did he? Did he read it? I genuinely can't remember.
Yeah, they had a couple of drinks in the Bull, didn't they? And then Ed was kind of hanging around watching them.
Mm, true that. That acted as somewhat of an accelerant for Ed and Emma to be back together.
Back together in harmony in their lovely caravan. It's just so cute, isn't it? It is really nice. I'm so glad they're like... I was really cynical about the whole kind of Ed and Emma thing for a long time. But now they're in there... like static home, everything's working out. She's going to have an amazing career as a kind of events organizer type person. And I just hope they can get through all of this stuff with Alice and Chris relatively unscathed.
I could not agree with you more. Second email?
Second email. Fantastic. So this is from Laurie F. Jones. And the title is My Origin Story. Hi, Royfield. I just wanted you to know what happened in the life of one miserable lockdown woman in Western Washington when you went on that English thing show with David Crowther. You asked for long emails. I hope you meant it. Here's my Archers fan origin story, because I know Royfield always wonders how us Yankees found their way into Ambridge. I've been addicted to soap opera since I was 10 years old, and soaps were a constant in my life for decades, and I always had something to talk about when I found myself having to make conversation with women I would otherwise have had nothing in common with. A sad thing happened several years ago with the changing of entertainment options in America. The soaps got increasingly awful, and then most were cancelled, leaving a gaping hole in my life. Then, one day, about 10 years ago, I think, I was looking for audio dramas on iTunes and discovered The Archers. My life was complete again.
Not too long ago, something else special happened in my life. It was when the pre-recorded episodes ran out, but before the monologue started. And in the US of A, we couldn't get the old episodes that were being aired. In my iTunes search, I found an episode of, oh crap, I forget the name. Something about things that are English. It was with David Crowther and Royfield Brown, two of my very favourite podcasters. And it was about the Archers. So I listened, and that's when I discovered Dumpty Dum. I had thought my life was complete again when I found the Archers after the demise of American soaps, but now my life was more than complete. Nothing could have gotten me through the shutdown and all the insanity taking place in my country now like Dumpty Dum has. I'm listening to the current shows, but the best hour of my day is when I walk my dogs in the evening and listen to the old episodes. I told you it'd be long. Thank you for providing the bright spot in an otherwise bleak and troubled year. Laurie.
It has been a terrible year. But you know what, though? A small little pinprick of loveliness, Laurie, has been your email. So thank you. Thank you. So that's the emails. So, folks, you know the drill. At this point, I go, right, take a break if you can. Oh, you can have a comfort break if you need one. Or a bio break, as Peter Fickling calls them, which how do you feel? With bio breaks over comfort breaks, which one would you prefer to have?
Comfort break.
Exactly. Bio break is a rather agricultural term to use, which is somewhat apt, I suppose, really, considering that we do a podcast about a rural soap. Oh, sorry, docudrama. Faux pas. Anyway, I'm wittering, which means go do what you need to do. Maybe put the kettle on. Have a wee. Do whatever. See the other side. It's social media roundup, and it's our Lillian.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Here, calling from the northeast of England, Middlesbrough, with this week's social media roundup. I've got my partner here doing the recording for me, so hopefully this will mean that we won't get any interruptions from the screen reader. Carolyn Wright said in Ambridge Addicts, she has done another one of these recordings that I was mentioning about the Vintage Archers, and this one that she's done is Dan and Doris in Heaven, and it talks about Dan giving Doris the up-to-date lowdown of what is happening in Ambridge. So it's worth checking that out because it is very funny. Meanwhile, Clive Dowdell in Archers Anonymous said, have a chat with Kate to crystallise Alice's fitness programme. And there's a photo, and the text inside it says, "You're Elite, you should try yoga. It will help you relax." And then she says back to Kate, "So does vodka, but without all that sweating." Cheryl McCulloch in Archers Anonymous says, "Susan is being totally selfish. She should do her share looking after Bert." And there were lots of agreement with this sentiment in all groups. Stuart Arundale in Upstairs at the Bull says, "Tracy, empty suitcase, ! Brilliant." Barbara Williams, in the meantime, in Academic Archers, is sure that Tracy got the tenancy transferred into her name when she first moved in with Bert. And Claire Asprey, very helpfully, could confirm that Tracy is joint tenant. Stephen Thomas declared that Alice will get drunk again and want a bit of Grundy magic. However, they will forget that the polytunnels are see-through. Ooh. Sandra Jenkinson agrees that Susan should do her fair share with Bert. Also, so should Gary, but she fears that Gary is a bit of a waste of space. Sean Coleman says, "Alice thinks a lot of herself, doesn't she?" And I think this was in respect of her thinking that Ed fancies her. Fiona Crawford says in Academic Archers, "I wonder what Gavin means by tying up loose ends with Kelly." Judith Lawrence wondered whether this was a throwaway comment or something more sinister. Sean Brown said in Dumpty Dum that he found the sound of Gavin and Philip's voices chilling. It stopped him in his tracks doing the washing up. Joan Smith wonders why Philip has such a beef with the good folks of Ambridge, especially when Oliver and Linda were so kind to him following the report into the fire. David Egan agrees with her. Meanwhile, Dawn wants Philip to redeem himself and make Kirsty happy. Good luck with that then, Dawn. Karen Ridley observes that all wrong-uns seem to diss Ambridge, and she asked if any positive characters have ever expressed negativity about it. Royfield declared that he misses Sid, finding him to be a reassuring presence. Many different views were expressed on this. Royfield also didn't like Nigel, despite really liking the actor who plays him, aka Graham Seed. He posed the question, what characters other members were unable to get behind? A lot of people commented, including our very own Yoko Bear, who said he has already made up his mind not to like Xander. Ooh. Take a look at the post for further details. Lots of people's opinions were expressed about how well Emma's handled the conversation with Chris about Alice's drinking. Many people felt she had handled it well. People were generally glad to have lots of dialogue back. In many groups, people thought Emma's remarks about if they don't like it, why don't they switch off, was a dig at the monologuers by the scriptwriters. Adrian Dowd in Archers Addicts has posted a very funny piece called The Ballad of Robert and Linda. It is based on the Victoria Wood song. I shared it in our group, so do check it out. The last thing I need to do now is just go through the results of the poll that Royfield put on about Kerry making the comment, who would inherit Brookfield. Lots of people voted and Pip won with a whopping 50 votes. I put a poll on today regarding if Susan is taken off Radio Borchester because of her squeaky voice, who would replace her? So do get voting, and Amber will be along next week with a social media roundup, and we'll give you the results of that poll. Well, that's it from me this week, folks. So have a great week and keep safe, everybody. Bye for now.
Thank you, Lillian. That was awesome. And it was tip top as always, my dear. Now, we move on from the social media roundup to tweet of the week. Now, Peter, Kerry has set the bar. I don't know whether it's high or low with tweets of the week, but let's see if you can surpass our Kerry. What are your tweets, sir?
Well, we've changed the format. It's now gold, silver and bronze. Tradition dictates, I'm going to start with bronze. It's not a criticism. At Vintage Year, aka Helen Wormsley Jade. See what I did there? Very slick segue. And so she has said, the fatal words, we've got a nice house, a great relationship and no problems. Oh dear, Chris.
Little titter. So basically, with each medal, right, the tittering should go up in terms of the volume, shouldn't it?
Oh, nothing makes you laugh like being instructed to laugh and how to laugh. Well, so, yeah, good luck with that.
All right, smashing. Silver, let's go.
Yeah. So silver, here we are. And it's someone who I'm in touch with on Twitter quite a lot, the wonderful Gay Grey Bell, at Gay Bell 21. And she said, is Tracy going for compensation? She has more front than the Village Hall. Love it. And as a big Tracy fan, you know, yes. And, oh, God, I've listened to this week now. My God, I couldn't love that woman more. Anyway, that's for the next week. And the gold medal position, drum roll, you know, huge excitement. Ian, at the Rotary.
Why don't we just play Aaron Copeland's Fanfare of the Common Man?
Because
that's what we always do, Peter.
Your own back on him at this point, Roy. Come on.
This is a good example of why maybe I'm a little bit chippy around Roy, because he's so much more educated and wise and clever than I am. And it's, so anyway, I don't even know what you're talking about. I can't even put the joke together. Anyway, so Ian at Rutherian, basically Rutherian, is how many times more have I told him no heavy lifting? Blake 7.
Well done.
Very good. Love that.
Yes, well done. Going to be lost on our American listeners, that one, but anyway.
Yeah. Imagine Star Trek. Now it's the homeopathic version of Star Trek, watered down to a quite extraordinary degree.
Mm. Due for a revival, Blake 7, I reckon.
Wasn't it one of those shows where they killed it off very prematurely? And a bit like Firefly, another sci-fi show, and the fans were absolutely livid. It started slowly, developed a bit of a following, and then the BBC just axed it, or was it maybe ITV? I don't know. But then it was axed quite brutally. But Firefly was a great show, and that got killed off for its time, but unleashed Josh Whedon on the rest of the world.
Well, I don't know about Firefly, but
you didn't like that.
Well, no, I'd never watched it. I know not of what you speak, but I know that Blake 7 was definitely the BBC.
A comic book fan who likes a bit of the Marvel universe would be unlikely to not enjoy Firefly. So I feel confident in saying give it a go, Royfield.
Mm. Rosie, just before we wrap things up, where do you stand with the superhero genre or with sci-fi?
Totally not in my realm. Do you remember Clive Barker? I liked his books, so I loved his books and that kind of thing, and Terry Pratchett many, many years ago, but I'm not a superhero movie fan. I'm more of a Room with a View kind of gal.
Me too. Yeah, I do like, you know, a slow contemplative type of story, whether that's displayed to me in book form or on a movie. But there's nothing like punching a baddie in the face. Do you know what I mean? Like punching him in the face and having a cape behind you whilst you're doing it for added effect.
Well, you like Firefly then. There's lots of face punching.
We'll give that a go.
I was just going to make one quick recommendation. So I haven't read it, but apparently there's a really amazing Korean comic about mums that's just come out. I saw a review of it in The Guardian the other day, and it sounds absolutely hilarious. It's all about middle-aged mums in Korea going around, having inappropriate romantic relationships, getting fired from their jobs, dead-end boyfriends. It's kind of like Ambridge, but in Korea.
Talking about Korean drama, what was that Korean film that got the Oscar?
Oh, I need to watch that.
Parasite. Parasite.
Yeah.
Parasite. Yeah.
Oh, I need have you seen that? Have you seen that, Rosie?
It's on my list. It's meant to be absolutely amazing.
It is utterly brilliant. Just a total dissection of a culture which is like ours but different. You know, so you got class, but then you have the quirkiness of the Korean culture viewed from, you know, a Western perspective, and it's just brilliantly acted. Doesn't go where you think it's going to go. Utterly stunning film. So if you want a little bit of Korean culture, folks, and you haven't seen Parasite, go watch that. So Peter, your homework for next week, go watch
I'll enjoy that. Yeah, and I've got a whole I could go on for hours about easy comparisons between Japan, Korea and Britain. I think there's a lot of similarities between particularly Japan and Britain, but anyway, that's a whole other conversation.
What, the whole island nation thing?
It's spooky how you know, these two countries off the coast of two continents that they have an awkward relationship with, but are undeniably connected to, you know, deeply and immediately, and how, you know, how that plays out in terms of issues around national identity and a sort of, you know, how that, and how that sense of national identity is sort of manipulated in modern politics.
Hmm. So would you say that our relationship, our being Britain's relationship to the island of Ireland, is akin to Japan and Korea?
This is where I don't know enough, and this is why I was excited about doing research for next week, or not that it'll get talked about next week, but you know, my lovely neighbours who are Irish have been educating me recently about how little I know about Ireland, and I thought I knew a decent amount. And similarly, I know that issues between Korea and Japan are very complicated and potentially fraught, and I don't know enough to talk about it without potentially saying something deeply offensive to any people who, you know a bit more and might be directly linked to it. Because, I mean, it is, you know, it's pretty damn complicated, and you know, I, as I said, I don't know enough.
Rosie?
Yes?
You've been about a bit.
Thank you for that.
You ever been to Japan or Korea?
No, I've been to Taiwan. So I've been to Taiwan about 20 years ago, and it was a fascinating place to visit. So I went to Taipei and then the South Coast, and the cultural shock of having a bowl of noodles that may or may not have bull's veins in it was one that I still remember to this day. And I was vegetarian at the time, but didn't quite understand how to communicate that. But amazing, amazing country to visit, and I'd love to go back.
Oh, let me just correct you. Country?
Taiwan's a country.
No, it's not. It's not.
Isn't it? Isn't it?
No, no, no.
What is it? Is it a state? Of where?
It doesn't have representation in the United Nations, so therefore is not a country. Though it acts as one.
But if you were to talk to a Taiwanese patriot, they might have a very different opinion, Royfield. And they might say their lack of nationhood is forced upon them rather than something that's felt or experienced or lived.
And yes, this is a burning issue in contemporary Taiwanese politics. But the island of Taiwan was to declare UDI, mainland China. Ooh. Goodness,
yeah, wouldn't be pretty at all.
However, that doesn't diminish from your observations of the cultural niceties or the strangeness from a Western perspective, and especially if you are vegetarian, your observations about the food which is served up in the island of Taiwan.
Very, very quick side note, my proudest moment was ordering a bowl of soup in Vietnam using a mishmash of French, Japanese and Chinese. And all I managed to do was order a bowl of soup. It was really quite difficult. And Rosie, I did not recognize. I knew there was animals in there, but I didn't recognize what animals, what part of the animals. And it was absolutely delicious.
If you've ever been to Vietnam, folks, why don't you go on to dumdydum.com go on to the show notes of this episode and you could tell us. You could just write it in the comments that I've been to Vietnam and used a mishmash of French, which resonates with Vietnam's colonial period, or the imperial overlordship of the Chinese era, and mashed it all up into a conversation. So I managed to order a bowl of soup. You can tell us in the comments on dundidum.com.
Now you say that, Royfield, it does make me feel a bit insensitive. Yeah, here's two conquering nations and their languages. Can I have some soup, please? Although I did throw some Chinese in as well. So, you know.
What, Cantonese or Mandarin?
Thank you for the clarification. Mandarin. the books I bought said Chinese on the front cover and in Mandarin in smaller text. So, you know.
If you want to comment on Pete's cultural insensitivity to the poor nation of Vietnam, a proud nation which has fought off French colonial battalions in the 1950s, the Americans in the 60s and the 70s, and even the French before in Bien Den Phu, one of the most stunning military victories in the 20th century. Go on to dumdydum.com and why don't you school Peter?
Thank you.
Now, something else you can do is to go onto patreon.com. And we have some new Patreons. And I'm going to go through the list of Patreons next week, because without the Patreons, we wouldn't really have a show worth talking about. Because Patreons, what they do, they're awesome people. And what they don't do is come out with crash cultural tropes about Vietnam. Oh, no, sirree, Bob. But what they do is they give us shekel. They give us $2 per show. And that means that we can pay for things around here, hosting, speak pipe, you know, coding, all this kind of stuff gets paid for with these $2 per show. So if you want to help us out, go on to patreon.com and donate $2 per show, and good things will happen to you. Oh, another way which you can help our enterprise is to go onto Apple iTunes, go write us a review. And in a couple of episodes' time, we will actually thank people who've written us reviews this year.
Remember, to get in contact, you can send a voice message via SpeakPipe on the website or call 0203-031-3105 to leave a message, or send a text message starting with dumb to 07786-200-690.
Smashing. Now, you know the drill. Twitter. It's one of the areas where Pete is stunning and I am not. And it's an area where that's how I know Auntie Kerry Warburton. Twitter, Twitter, Twitter. And of course, Twitter is what birthed the dum-de-dums. So if you want to go onto Twitter and tweet, why don't you follow Peter? So Peter, someone wants to follow you on Twitter. How can they do that?
Pete Fickling.
Rosie Porty. I think you're new to the social media platform, aren't you?
I am. I only joined Twitter in the past, I think, 6 weeks, Royf. But I've been very prolific since then, and I love it. It's really, really good fun. And I'm at Porty Rosie.
Ooh, smashing. All right. And I talked about Bien Den Phu before, which is stunning victory by the North Vietnamese against the colonial French. It was about 1954. Somebody could correct me on the exact date of that. But do you know the reason why Portobello is called Portobello?
So it could be to do with the Italians and a war, but I'm probably completely wrong and will get, you know, shouted at by Portobello historians everywhere.
It is the battle against the Spanish. I think it's a naval battle in the 18th century. No, I don't think I know, because that's the reason why Portobello Road in London is thus named. I think it's the War of Jenkins Ear. So it's the 18th century. But anyway, isn't it interesting how foreign words come into the English language and place names, and we kind of forget their foreign roots? It's just Portobello just is. But of course, it's not at all Anglo-Saxon. And I'm wittering. And at that point, I say, you can follow me on Twitter, but there really is literally no point, because all I do is just post pictures of my folks, really. But if you want to do that, at Royfield, spelled R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D. And of course, if you want to follow the show and various Archers related goings on, there is at dumdydum. Of course, there is Facebook, the new group in our doing really well, folks. It's awesome. It's alive. It's bustling, full of dumdydumbers talking about stuff. So quite simply, go onto Facebook, type in dumdydum. It's the group, not the page. I haven't actually switched the page off yet. I think I'll do it this week. But the group is going so well. And thank you to the new social media admins for keeping that whole show on the road. That's that. Oh, also big up to Flickat Posse, Flickat people. I love you lots. Chest puffed out and all of that. And that's that. That's been us doing a dum-de-dum. Auntie Kerry Warburton will be back from her holes next week. But Rosie Porty, how did it feel to sit in our Kerry's seat?
Kind of warm and comfortable and inspiring. It's been a fantastic experience. But I'm sure Kerry is going to be rocking her form next week. So thanks for having me.
Oh, listen, we'll have you back again. Was the seat still warm?
It was still warm, yeah.
Wasn't it the worst when you're a little kid and you had to sit on the bus and the seat was warm? You went, oh, someone's bottom's been here. Pete, how do you think our Rosie Porty did?
Oh, fantastically. I think that's self-evident.
Smashing. Should we have her back again?
Absolutely, yes. Get rid of me, Rosie and Kerry forever. That's definitely the way forward, yeah.
You can't do that to the listeners, Pete. You've got so many fans out there.
No.
They would be crying.
Last week I was told I talk too much. This week I've been told I bully Roy Field and I'm unpleasant. And I think, you know, I think it can be, you can see it in my performance this week. I was a little bit cowed and nervous.
Peter, let the truth set you free, sir.
Yeah, I just offered that. I just offered to be set free. But anyway, I'm gonna go and lick my wounds and maybe I'll have the courage to come back next week. Maybe, you know, and try again.
Smashing. All right, folks, that's been us doing the dum-de-dums for another 7 days. See you all again soon. Tatty bye. Ta-ra a bit.
Bye.
Bye.